Today's episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Quote now at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey folks, just wanted to give you a heads up. This will contain spoilers for late in the season developments. So if you haven't caught up, first off, bold choice for listening to this first. I respect you for that, but you might want to listen to the whole season first before listening to this discussion. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. And as always, Arden is brought to you by Wayface Industries, the good people.
Hello and welcome to the first commentary-ish track for Arden. We're talking about the first episode, which I have already forgotten the name of. So
Dave did, my God.
Aliens did it. Yes, we are going to, instead of doing a straight commentary, because it feels weird to do a commentary on an audio-only thing, we're just doing a little discussion. We're going to talk for 45 minutes to an hour about this episode, and everybody's getting to listen to this one, and if you are a Patreon subscriber, you'll get to listen to commentaries for every other episode, so good for you. Go subscribe. Patreon.com/ArdenPod. I am Todd Vanderwerf, co-creator. I think I wrote the first draft of this. I don't know. We wrote this in 2016. Who knows? But I am joined by...
This is Christopher Dole. I am a co-creator of Arden, and I participated in that first 2016 draft somehow. Like, that first nonsense draft that we did back in 2016.
And also...
I am Sarah Golub. I am a co-creator and co-writer of Arden, and I had nearly nothing to do with this episode.
No.
I think I cut a bunch of stuff.
You did. You cut a bunch of stuff.
The most valuable contribution of all.
Yes. It's not 3 hours long, and for that, you are welcome.
Yes. Like, a lot. There was a lot of stuff that was in this episode that got moved to, I think, episode 3. I think is where it landed.
Yeah, all of the Wallace stuff.
Yeah, it
was from the original draft of this episode.
I'm gonna dig up.
Wallace was set up to be a much bigger character than he was.
He was gonna be so important. He wasn't at all. He just I thought the name Wallace I thought was fun, and then but yeah, I do think originally he was gonna be more important, and then he's in one scene, so. Anyway, before we talk about the pilot, I realized we also did a teaser that a lot of people have listened to, and I had almost nothing to do with that. So why don't you two talk about just kind of the teaser? Just give me 2-3 minutes on how that came to be.
I wrote a draft of the teaser, and I think I fundamentally misunderstood what we were doing, because it is one of those things where, I wrote it, and I thought it was, two ads, and then it was, one ad, and I was like, oh, this is long for one ad, and then we fixed it through the magic of editing.
Yeah, what happened was you had written sort of, two separate ads, one for Bea and one for Brenda, and somehow it got conflated into one ad where we first hear Bea, then we hear Brenda, and then we get the two of them together.
I think that – so, I read the teaser, and I definitely was under the impression reading Sarah's script that, oh, yes, it was going to be all part of one thing. I thought it worked really well that way, which is why I did not give the note, let's make this more –
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like the teaser that we have very much. And one, I would like to credit Chris Hadfield, our composer, for that great like Western twang that comes in, because that to me is like, I think that was like the moment, because we were still like rushing to finish editing the episodes. That was like the moment where I was like, oh, this could be good.
Yeah, you're going to hear
thing we made.
You're going to hear a lot about Chris Hadfield in these commentaries and how he saved us.
Yes.
Many times.
A hero and a scholar.
I think a recurring theme of this show is going to be, here's Michelle Agresti. She saved us. Here's Tracy Syed. She saved us. Lindsay Zanna. Yes. Chris Hadfield, literally everybody who's not us. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, great. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. So,
yes.
I'm searching my Google Drive. I found the original pitch that Chris and I made at the time we had a manager, and we pitched this to him. So I found the original Arden pitch. Do you want me to read that? It's like a page of text. So.
Yes.
All right. Okay.
Okay. This is the pitch, not the elusive show Bible.
Not the show Bible, which I'm still looking for. I'm also looking for
9 pages long.
The very first pilot. Okay. So
I found it by searching for Arden pregnant to prove a point.
All right. So this is, I think, before.
Oh my God! There was a Lieutenant Paris. My God, we got off track, guys.
Okay.
We sure did.
Well, this very first thing, the death of Julie Capson spelled with an N, or the disappearance of Julie Capson with an N, rocked the nation. A famous heiress, prima for life, etc., about to go off to college and change the world, yada, yada, yada. That feels like a little vague. All right. It was believed that she was kidnapped and killed by fellow student Ralph Montgomery. Hey, that stayed. A poor kid who also vanished around the same time. He was called a bad apple, slandered in the press, accused of stalking her, and ultimately abducting and murdering her. Neither was ever found by the police, and things quieted down after a while. 10 years later, the Capsons are endowing a new charity in Julie's name. International Press Radio Network reporter B is doing a puff piece covering the Capsons and the charity when she is contacted by an intriguing new source. All of this disappeared. Ben, a former police officer, now runs a failing PI firm called Arden. Ben had worked on the Capson case as a young cop and always had a crazy theory as to what had really happened. Namely, that Ralph had actually been dead for about 2 days before Julie disappeared, and Julie is actually alive somewhere. Hey, that kind of stayed. While that first meeting ends badly, the two immediately mix like oil and vinegar. Bea is intrigued by Ben's theory and the evidence behind it. She smells a good story, not just the puff pieces she generally works on, but a genuine uncovering of some of the most powerful and mysterious people in the town on one of the biggest cases of the last decade. She persuades her boss at the network to let her do a longer investigative piece on Julie Capson's murder. However, it comes with a stipulation. Her boss, finding Ben to be one hell of a character, hires him to be her partner for the duration of the investigation, much to her chagrin. The more the two start looking at the case, the stranger it gets. The evidence against Ralph is extremely circumstantial, in particular the question of time, missing chunks of time in which no one can quite recall what happened, details of Ralph and Julie's relationship that don't match up from story to storyteller, with an additional 10 years of fog descended over it. But as they increasingly become convinced that Ralph is innocent and the real culprit is still out there, Bea and Ben are going to figure out the truth no matter who's in their way, which often as not includes themselves, given their propensity to start arguing at the drop of a hat. Hey, that stayed. Arden is an ongoing scripted podcast, a riff on the entire Shakespeare canon by way of Serial and Moonlighting, with a primary focus this first season on Much Ado About Nothing and Romeo and Juliet. It's a comedic, serialized mystery show, each episode running between 20 and 30 minutes. That did not stay.
Oh boy.
The first season will tackle the Ralph Julie case, while future seasons would take on different cases. Each episode is narrated by Bea and Ben about a new step in the case, including introducing the new evidence and also fighting about who's narrating the episode and about what exactly the evidence means. But also along the way, Ben and Bea are working through their own contentious relationship. Both are coming to realize how much the other means to each other, but both are strong-willed, and after all their bickering, neither is going to be the first one to actually admit their feelings for the other, but maybe, just maybe, love will conquer all. I mean, it's there.
Yeah.
I can definitely see why our manager was way more excited about like every other pitch here, though. Yeah, so that was the original idea. The original idea, this is the question that I get asked the most, which is, where did the idea come from? And the original idea was, I listened to a lot of true crime podcasts and a couple audio dramas, and I just was like, Serial crossed with Moonlighting. That sounds like fun. And then I promptly forgot about that. And then Chris was like, let's do this. And then like a year later, I came in and Chris was like, I have this whole thing ready. And I was like, okay.
Yeah. So really the thing that hooked me about your pitch was the fact that in all of these true crime shows, even sort of like the fictionalized ones, you get one narrator, you get one sort of definitive, like, voice of the truth. And maybe there's some like unreliability in there, but we're supposed to take this person at their word that they are going to be the final arbiter of what really happened in this case.
Yeah.
And your pitch immediately shook that up. It was like, it's taking away sort of the biggest cornerstone of this kind of show and throwing it into chaos. And that stayed with me. It was like that, there's a core there. There is something there that even like as the months sort of like dragged on, it was like, this is too good to let go. We have to see if we can do something with this. And because of the nature of sort of audio drama and this sort of do-it-yourself culture and environment that's developing with it, we can do something with this. So it was like, it was the correlation of those two things made it last.
Right, right. Sarah, what were your thoughts on this when you came in? Because this script was largely written when you joined, but we changed a lot of it. So I want to know your thoughts on like just the idea when you were brought on board.
You know, I was just flattered to be asked. I liked that the mystery was already sort of figured out, because I have I love mysteries, but then whenever I'm like trying to outline one, I get really really caught up in like these big ideas of like this twist and this twist and this twist and this twist, and then I never finish anything because it's you get lost in those twists. So it was appealing to be like, oh, great, I will show up and I will do the characters and the jokey jokes and the banter and flesh out these female characters. Definitely one of the things I was apprehensive about was like Ben as a character. So glad that guy's gone.
Yeah. Should we talk a little bit about the sort of the very first version of this script?
I literally just dug it up, so why not?
Yeah.
I'm skimming it, and most of this stuff survived, but also like a lot of it didn't. Like, it didn't survive in this form. One of the things I think the second half of the season is stronger than the first half, and I think the big reason for that is the first three episodes especially are very wedded to, this is a true crime show that just happens to exist in a fictional format. And like, true crime's a lot of exposition, which is the thing you don't realize until you try to write a fake one. And looking at this first one, like some of this stuff survived. Like, it opens with Andy saying Arden is sponsored by Wayface Industries. Like, that made it.
Arden is sponsored, as always, by Wayface Industries, the good people.
And the opening, Julie, the opening Bia talking about Julie's disappearance, that's pretty similar to what ended up in the other show. But then you jump to, like, Bia drives to Eureka and talks to Wallace, and, like, like, that didn't, you know, that made it to episode three. So I don't remember precisely why we changed everything we did, because like the new, there were essentially four drafts of this, and the third one, it was still like Brenda was still a man named Ben, and we didn't change that until really late
Yeah, I think I did like a find replace on my draft of episode 5 at some point.
Yeah, so, but I think a lot of it did come from stripping down because, as I recall, for a while, you know, the episode always had the two-part structure where you meet Bea and she sort of takes us through the first half. Mm-hmm. And then the second half was always Ben / Brenda.
Mm-hmm.
But from my memory, what originally happened and the original cause of that divide was Andy almost literally breaking the door down on Bea. And sort of after the initial interview of Ben, Brenda, who to this point had not been introduced as the co-host. He had only been introduced as just this other
right.
person
right.
that is being interviewed. And what happens is Andy basically just bursts into the recording studio and demands that Ben be put on the show or it be shut down or something because he's concerned about how the detective agency is going to look.
Yeah.
And then like Bea and the boss, who at that point was named Pedro, left and left Ben alone with the recording, which he noticed was still on. And then he starts talking as a way to try to clear his name. And
that, yeah, that monologue we trimmed way back. That one of the first things. So we did a read through of the script, and Tracy Syed was there, and she read Bea. We just did the first one, and she, like, the big note everybody had was people talk way too long. Like, you need to trim back what everyone's saying. And then, as I recall, Tracy had to leave to go do something else. And we were like, let's read episode 2. And my wife, Libby, was there. She co-wrote episode 11. And she read for Ben. And I think Christina, who did some of our editing, read for Bea.
Yeah, Christina Hollerin, who edited episodes 2 and 4.
And those, like, suddenly there was something there. The, like, two women clashing was suddenly more interesting in some weird way. And that's when we really seriously started thinking about making Ben Brenda. Unfortunately, we hadn't written so much of the season that it was like a huge problem. Like, we could literally do a find replace and make a few small tweaks here and there. I'm like looking at our original description of Ben from the very original script was Ben says, let me tell you a little bit. The third thing she, meaning Bea, has told you is probably that I'm devastatingly handsome, or, you know, not that, because you can just about hear it in my voice, can't you? So let me tell you a little about me. Picture Magnum P.I. era Tom Selleck. Take the mustache off. Throw it away. We don't want the mustache. Now picture Moonlighting era Bruce Willis, but give him better hair. And okay, I'll say it, a little bit of a beer belly. Last thing I want you to imagine is Tilda Swinton in that movie where sometimes she's a man and sometimes she's a woman, depending on the century. You kind of have a picture now, right? I'll bet. I was so proud of that Tilda Swinton line, and like that went out the window right away. So.
Yeah.
Not enough people have seen Orlando, apparently. but yes, so the big creative change we made was Ben became Brenda, and then the show, that was when the show really started to become itself. And I would also say another thing about this early draft is I was writing it very clearly, hearing in my head a true crime podcast. So there's a lot of stuff where it's like you'll cut in a clip from the field. And like, it's not clear that that's happening. And when we went, and even when we got to the final script, when we went and started recording, like, I think that I had to make that more clear. Like, it did not occur to me that people would not realize that, you know, there would be different sound qualities and things like that.
Yeah, I think one of the most important things we discovered in the process was the click stop, the click play sound effect that you hear throughout the show. It is so useful in providing that sense of transition and pace to the show.
Another thing, and I don't want to steal this is Sarah's observation, but another thing that we accidentally did was we have a format where everybody says where they are.
Big fan of that.
So invaluable in a format where nobody can actually see what's happening.
And I like that we, the very fictional show Arden, which is recorded in a studio. I like that we travel in that, like, they actually will go to someone's house to talk to them. Because a lot of the true crime stuff I listen to will be interviews, which does have a sense of, like, this is obviously a new person talking, and they're just in the same void room that everyone else is in, because people are coming in here to record. And so, yeah, the cutting around is a little more tricky when you're like, we're in Eureka now, and it's like, what? You need to say that.
Yeah.
There needs to be a sense that Eureka takes place, that Eureka sounds different than the recording studio in Los Angeles. Because otherwise, what are we doing?
And that's a big thing we're talking about with season 2, is finding a way to do more things that sound different. Because I think, yes, if we have thoughts on season 1, it's that the sound quality is often kind of samey. And, like, that's just because that we were not, like, in a place where we could do wild sound design elements. But I think now that we kind of have a season under us, we're thinking about that more.
Yeah. And to get back to that original script, I think there was a lot of paring down, but also one of the fundamental changes that we discovered going on was that we did not want Andy as an antagonist, and we did not need him as an antagonist, because he was very much that in the initial version of this show.
Now, this is interesting, because you've said this a number of times, and I'm reading this script, and I never saw him as an antagonist. And, like, maybe this is just my view of human relationships, but he comes in and like the first that script, which I remember we kind of got. I think this was a note we got from the manager, was like, there needs to be more conflict,
right?
That script, definitely the element of the hostile takeover of the radio station is more important. But Andy's not quite himself, but still pretty much like kind of an idiot savant who, like, just is having a good time.
And I don't mean to say he was, like, evil
or
anything. He was never evil. But there was definitely more of, like, is the conflict he's currently providing necessary, or is it a distraction?
Do you guys remember when the decision sort of happened to kind of take Andy out of the show until, like, episode 4? Because we do the thing where we don't reveal that the Andy Wayface, who's their boss, is the guy recording the audio with them, which is one of those weird reveals, because I know it the whole time, I really can't be, like, tracking what that must be like for the audience and if they're even noticing or thinking about it.
I feel like it was just sort of a decision of simplicity, of, like, okay, let's just try to keep this episode as contained as possible, where we introduce, because we're introducing a lot anyway. We're introducing Bea, we're introducing Brenda, we're introducing Julie, we're introducing Natalie, we're introducing Vince, we're introducing the torso, we're talking about Gerald, we're talking about the drive for Beverly Hills. There's a lot going on in this episode already. If there are things that we could take out, then take them out.
Yeah. The original pilot had most of the regulars in it. Rosalind is the only one who doesn't appear in the original episode 1. We have Pamela, who at that time was named Pedro, because apparently we thought the show was going to have men in it. and Andy is a much bigger part. And we definitely have the, Wallace is all over it for some reason. Wallace is apparently very important. I think that we quickly realized the thing we needed to do in the first episode was introduce the case.
It might be hard for younger listeners who've only known her as the lost girl to realize this. But for people of a certain age, well, my age, Julie Capsom was someone you knew all too well. Someone you maybe even grew up with.
And this is just my memory, but also looking at the script sort of confirms it. The case stayed pretty much the same. Does that sound right?
I think the introduction of the case stayed pretty much the same.
The central facts.
I think everything that happens up until
I would say there's
no way, because the timeline stuff, there's no way to say this in a way that makes sense. I'm like, you know, everything leading up to the drive is the same, which is not true, but like the drive Julie takes, that stayed the same. Plan to disappear stayed the same. The basic setup, and then, you know, pretty much anything you hear after like episode 9 is like new. But
yes. But definitely, like, and I wrote a little bit about this. If you're a Patreon subscriber, you may have read the blog post I wrote about it. There is a famous cold case in New Hampshire, a woman named Maura Murray, literally a lot of this is in the show, but like she just randomly ran away from her college. It seemed like she was preparing for a long trip. She crashed her car into a tree in the snow, and she was like 10 hours away from home. And then she just wandered off, and nobody still knows what's happened to her. And like, the safe bet is that she wandered off into the woods and got lost because it was snowing and died of exposure. But there are still like theories. There are a lot of theories that she survived and like now is living in Los Angeles and has a daughter, and she ran away because she was pregnant, which is eerily similar to a thing we almost did without me knowing about that theory. And also there are theories that she was murdered by someone and is like, you know, in their basement, buried down there or something. So that was where a lot of it came from. I literally don't remember where the torso came from. And the torso is, I just was having coffee with David Reinstrom the other day. And he was talking about the torso as like the thing that when he tells his friends about the show that hooks them. And like, I don't remember where it came from. It's fun. Like, I like that there's this weird horror element there.
That's when things got weird. And we haven't even gotten to the torso yet. I can promise you, we'll definitely get to the torso.
Yeah, I think that sort of came in like pretty early as like, okay, we need to punch this up somehow. We need this other element. But yeah, whenever I talk to people about the show and I say there's a torso in the truck, people are like, oh, tell me more.
Yeah, when I was making my friends listen to the teaser trailer, just sitting them down and being like, you got 2 minutes, listen to this. Definitely when they mention the torso is like the moment where you like see on their face where they're like, oh, there's a torso involved.
But yeah,
that poor torso.
I do want to say, like, when we started the show, we were pretty sure Julie was alive. We thought Ralph was alive. We weren't sure, but we kind of had that. I did not yet realize we were doing Romeo and Juliet, which is on me. what you should know about our creative process is I'm the one who listens to all the true crime podcasts, so nobody else has to. but I also don't read the Shakespeare plays at all. I really try not to. So I think we knew Julie was alive. I think we knew we had a vague idea that Ralph was with her. We had a vague idea that maybe they had a kid. I think we had the helicopter. I think we had all of that.
Yes.
But literally everything else was kind of up in the air, especially the identity of the torso, who was making the phone call, all of these things we didn't know. So,
yeah.
I'm looking at what else sort of stayed the same from this first ad and this first draft. And I just gave away where I'm going, because one of the things that stayed the same is literally we have never changed a word of the Sockety Doo-Dah ad.
Well, how could we?
Like that. And what was kind of sad about that was I wrote that as a thing where I was like, this will never happen. And then immediately, like, mail order sock services started advertising on podcasts. And, like, I'm cursed, basically.
Yeah, I like, a few months ago got some bullshit. Are we swearing on this?
Okay. Yeah, swear all you want.
Why not? I think we already have, so.
Oh, great, great, great. Some bullshit online content creator gig where I made like a jokey fake ad for a very real sock company that just sends socks to your door, and I was just like doing that whole thing, being like, This is the hell I've opened myself up to with Aaron.
Like,
I now understand Bia.
Like, literally to the point where Andy, who we, you know, changed a lot from this draft, like, his line in the ad where he says, "Who doesn't love a sock party?" has stayed also exactly the same. So
people are supposed to believe that I do this.
Who doesn't love a sock party?
Yeah,
Look, some things don't need to change.
So where did the ads come from? Like, that's always been there. It's always been part of the show. Like, it's here in this first draft of the pilot. But also, like, I don't recall the two of us having a conversation where it was like, oh, we're going to do ads when we started writing.
Well,
you have to, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely have to. If you're doing a parody, and this did start off as more of a parody, then you have to do fake ads. It's a demand of the genre.
Okay. I still constantly think of how, like, MailChimp, like, really wants that sweet, sweet child moto money for being involved in cereal.
Because it is such a surreal thing.
Yeah.
Like, to just be listening to this gruesome murder and then, oh, you need some, here's a food order service, here's a clothing service, here's sheets, like, buy sheets.
Yeah, and it is great exposure for them, but it's just so weird that that's like the thing they're tied to, that they want to be tied to.
Mm-hmm. And so many.
Anyway, if you're listening, please sponsor Arden. We will not make fun of you if you sponsor us.
And so many of these shows, the ads are done by the host, which of course is also our conceit. Like, the ones where I think it kind of works. And we're going to talk a lot about how In the Dark, the true crime podcast, is like the one true crime podcast that, like, we think does everything right. When they do ads, the host doesn't read them. It cuts to a different voice. And like that, I think, works. But like when you listen to the host be like, and then they found the torso. And then she's like, I love socks. In fact, I don't know where I'd be without them.
Like, yeah. The juxtaposition is so insane.
And this is another place where I think Chris Hatfield really underlined this for us, because his ad music was so good and such a break from the mood of the rest of the show that, like, he wrote three or four pieces. We overused all of them, but in wonderful ways, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's helpful to have, like, at least for me, I hope the audience likes it, but for me, it's nice to be like, this music means an ad is playing, and that's how you know you're not listening to the regular show.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need those kinds of cues to let you know those sort of structural things are happening.
Yeah, it is Bia or Brenda talking, so you you do need to make sure that it doesn't sound like Bia is just having a conversation about how she loves socks.
Yeah, one thing that I know, at least I try to do...
Yeah. Who doesn't love socks?
Yeah, one thing I always tried to do when I was writing was, if one of Bia or Brenda sort of ends the segment, it's the other one who does the ad. To at least have that sort of transition, so it's not just one voice, then the same voice, so that it's always one voice, then a different voice.
I just tried to get everybody in the show to do ads, like... Literally, yeah. I think I wrote both. No, I didn't write the Wait 8 ad, but I wrote the other two Andy ads, and I wrote the one that Pamela and Rosalind do, I think in episode 9.
Well, Wait 8's not technically an Andy ad because Bia's right, reading Bia reads copy, it, and then she just starts interviewing Andy about his no life. But, you know, let's save that for the episode 6 commentary. Or yeah, you can read
yes,
about it.
Yes, we could. Yeah, we will be able to do the episode 6 commentary entirely about Waydate. There's enough to dig into there.
I think we should talk about casting, but I do, before we get to casting, I want to talk about Michelle, how she reads the ads, which is like my favorite thing about her performance.
She's so good. She's a very, very good actress who really creates and grounds the character of Bia and makes her feel very real to me. But like, absolutely my favorite acting trick she does is just clearly hating the ads.
Like, I think she was given the direction, like, you basically have a gun to your head right now when you are doing this. Did she run with it?
I'm not going to say what podcast we told her to listen to because it is a wonderful podcast that I love, but the host always sounds like she would rather be doing anything but reading ads. And Michelle just took that to heart. And like, she, in the latter half of the season, she does some amazing emotional stuff and she lands these big emotional moments. But I'm all like, always for me, the moment when I'm like, I love this performance is when she says, I love socks.
I love socks. In fact, I don't know where I'd be without them.
But yes, let's talk about casting. Because yes, we had a pretty, I won't say arduous, it was fine. Like, we had a good time. But it became very clear to us. I want to talk about that because I had never cast a thing before. And
right,
I had heard that thing that people say, when you see the right person, you know. And that literally happened when we had Michelle and Tracy come in and read opposite each other. It was like, oh, okay, this is going to be fine. Michelle was the first person to read for the whole thing.
She was. Yeah. She was. And then Shannon Estabrook was the second person.
So, yeah.
And we thought this was going to be so easy.
Yeah, and Michelle and Shannon, go ahead.
Yeah, so yeah, we had put out ads in a couple of sort of the casting aggregate websites that are out there for Los Angeles, and we had over 500 submissions for the show, which, considering it was for an audio drama from people who had no experience making one, I'm not quite sure what that says,
yeah,
but it was something.
We had a lot of auditions that clearly weren't right.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of people. We had a lot of people where we kind of fought about them. Like, for instance, one of the people who ended up in the cast, Robert Fleet. I remember I was like a big proponent of just like bringing him in to have him read because he was so different from everybody else who auditioned, but also like he put in for Ben, which at the time Ben became Brenda, and like it was like that wasn't gonna happen, you know, like he wasn't right for that part. But so like, yeah, it was kind of literally,
I think he put in for Andy.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah, we may have had him read for that. But yeah,
he could have made, Robert could have done a really good Andy. It's hard to imagine any other Andy, but I think there was a version of Andy that was a little more insidious in his whimsy, and I think Robert would have really killed that.
Well, what happened, speaking of people coming in and you just knowing that's the right person, so Ben Watts.
Ben Watts, a hero.
He submitted initially for Ben Bentley, the character who became Brenda.
Mm-hmm.
And he came in and he did a good reading.
Yeah.
And then we just almost on a whim asked him to read for Andy. And that voice just came out of nowhere.
Yeah. Because he does, you know, normally he has a like an American accent. He can do like Australian is, I think, his native
accent.
He's
from Australia.
Yeah, he's from Australia. Yeah. He was in a Good Place episode as an Australian. And I was like, where do I know that guy from? Because his voice is so different when he does the Australian thing. But yeah, the kind of vaguely Scottish thing, vaguely Sean Connery, like, I don't even know. It was great. We you know, really wanted him in the cast, and because he was so good. And then I think the Andy thing was just like what sealed it. And we kept writing to that, like in a way where we were kind of worried about Andy, because this is the other part of the origin story we didn't talk about, which is we scrapped the idea that Andy was kind of hostile takeovering the radio station after the 2016 election, because it felt a little dark, and it felt a little too close to social commentary, which we didn't want to do until we started doing social commentary.
Like the two of us, I think we had lunch, I think it was that Thursday or Friday after the election, and we were just sort of sitting there in this really nice like Japanese curry restaurant, both kind of still shell-shocked from what had happened.
And I think at that time we thought Arden was probably dead, because we thought the idea that Bia was fighting against the radio station being taken over was too integral to the show. So now we just have this multinational corporation that, like, we never really interrogate it, because if we do, then we might have to think about the evil things it does. But we just pretend it's basically wholesome, and Andy is a good person. It's a corporation and a religion. You know, that's all we can ask for.
A way of life.
But yeah, like after we saw Michelle and Shannon, we thought, well, this is going to be either really easy or really tough, because everybody's going to be this good. And then we had a long string of people who weren't good. The people who we wanted in the show stood out, and we kind of reconfigured the show around them. Like Charlita Gaston came in, and we were like, we really like her voice. We really like what she's doing. We don't really have a character for her, but also we have this Pedro character who we haven't done anything with. So let's just make that actually, I believe, was Sarah's pitch, was we just turn it into Pamela, and like we went from there.
And then we also had the sort of the more ensemble type people, like John Rail or Mia Drake, who it's like, we like these people. We're going to figure out a character for them that they can sort of come back as. But we also know they will be really good utility players.
Right. And one of the one of my favorites where that happened was Lindsay Syme, who plays Natalie. Natalie is low-key my favorite character all season, because she's like such a sweet person, but also like covering up a massive crime, like without,
but
like,
out of love,
without breaking a sweat.
Also possibly associated with that.
Yes. But
out
like
love.
That was a thing where I don't know that Natalie would have been as important a character. Like she might have just been in the first episode being like, yeah, Julie was my best friend. But Lindsay Syme came in and like instantly you had a sense just from her voice of like Natalie's wealth, Natalie's upbringing, all this stuff, and like Natalie's sadness over losing her friend. And we kept writing to that. And like that was the thing that happened a lot. Like we had these actors, like John Rail suddenly revealed he could do a great Liverpudlian accent. And we were like, okay, what are we gonna do with that?
We're gonna keep bringing back Sean Stone for like no reason at all.
It's really fascinating the way these things happen. Like I hear TV showrunners talk about it all the time in my day job, and like it's really true. Like you just hear something and you're like, okay, that's it.
And we were just so lucky that we kept having that happen. Like it was extraordinary, because like, no, aside, I mean, Tracy was your friend, but otherwise all these people just found us.
And Tracy had never done audio drama, and like I don't think it was on her radar at all. And literally it was just like, I've worked with Tracy almost 20 years now. Like we knew each other in college, and we were in Sweeney Todd together. She was Mrs. Lovett. I was like a person who pushed scenery around.
That's still kind of what's happening.
Yeah, basically. One of the things that, so we're giving credit to our wonderful cast, our wonderful composer, all these people who made the show what it was. But I do want to give us credit for recognizing those things and for running toward them when they were happening, instead of like we let go of some ideas because it just they didn't work with what we sort of ended up having in the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I want to give us credit for that.
Cool. Well, but, thank you.
Mostly me.
Go but, team. No, I mean,
yeah.
We are recording like an hour of us just talking about how great our show is. So yeah. I think some level of humility is the bare minimum we could be doing right now.
Speaking of humility,
we love the show and we think we did a great job and we're geniuses.
Speaking of humility, should we talk a little bit about the production and post-production process?
Yeah, I just wanted to shout out Elizabeth O'Bear, who recorded most of our episodes, was our sound engineer, did a terrific job, was unable to continue with the show in the way that both she and we had hoped, because she like is a professional sound person in Hollywood and like has other jobs that pay her more than we did. But the reason this show sounds good at all has so much to do with the fact that we were in a pretty noisy space where we were recording, and she like found a way of making it sound like a studio. So thank you so much, Elizabeth. Anytime you want to stop by again, we're happy to have you.
Yes, thank you.
Elizabeth was a lifesaver.
Yes. Please pay Elizabeth some real money for her professional look.
So this episode was recorded on Saturday, November 11th, 2017. Sunday, November 12th, 2017. Saturday, December 2nd, 2017. And Saturday, February 24th, 2018. To give you a little glimpse of what our behind the scenes process was like.
Right.
Yeah. I think we recorded, to really put that in perspective, I think we recorded episode 11 on either November 12th or 11th. But it was like, it was the same exact day a year apart from the pilot.
Yeah. And the reason we did the February date was when we did pickups on the monologues, right?
Yes.
Because
and this is actually in large part on me, because I was the one who did all of the scheduling of when we were going to record things. And so on that first day, I figured, well, to let Michelle and Tracy get their sort of sea legs under their characters, let's have them record all of their monologue stuff first. What could go wrong?
They were so boring. Like they just had no life to them because they didn't know the characters. And they were just long. We also edited them a lot. They turned into long walls of text. And
Like the initial Bia monologue, even before the credits, was close to 10 minutes. In its first version, it was like a nightmare. And this is not on Michelle at all.
No.
Like, okay, she did what she could.
And there are lots of radio shows, fictional and non-fictional, that are one person talking and it totally works. I mean, mm-hmm. There's so many episodes of Welcome to Night Vale before you hear anyone else talk, but it's still like thoroughly engaging. So it's very much on us for not realizing that that's not what the show is. This is a ensemble show.
Right. Yeah. I really had Limetown in mind when I wrote the pilot, and Limetown has a lot of long monologues, but Limetown is also an atmospheric horror show. And we are not that like comedy.
Yeah. And I remember,
go ahead.
And I was going to say, and I remember coming in and saying, we have to introduce Brenda like within the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's not what I would have started with.
I don't think anyone wants to hear how you would have started.
Oh, don't get me wrong. It was very professional.
Because that's the key to the show, is their interaction.
And I resisted that for a long time because I felt like we needed to essentially have the wrestling term K, I can never think of how to pronounce it. I think it's kayfabe. Yeah. Like, we needed to essentially let people think this was a real true crime show for basically the first half of the pilot. But that was deadly boring. And you were right. Like we needed to get the element in there of conflict. And I've re-listened to the season, and I still think the first half of the pilot, like, maybe could use a little more juice. And that's mostly me, because I really wanted it to sound like a true crime show. I didn't quite realize that, like, how obvious it would be it was not a true crime show, that it was a fake crime show.
Yeah, I think what's kind of interesting about those sorts of decisions, and in general, like, our process writing Arden, is that the three of us are fundamentally TV people. We've all written pilots. We all came to LA in the hopes of one day getting that big show. And I think, you know, the reason why our Arden episodes are like 40 to 50 minutes long is because we're trying to write a TV show. And a lot of the learning curve was learning how to actually make it an audio drama. But there are things where I think a lot of the mistakes we made is we were like trying to write our impression of a radio show. And it's with stuff like bringing Brenda in, is like, that's a TV thing, is it's like, people are going to change the channel, get to it. And that background has served us well, I think, ultimately. Even if there's a lot of things where we got this is an episode 2 thing, we'll talk about in episode 2, but I was like kind of just trying to write my version of a Law and Order procedural type thing, which I know how to write, but it was like an impression of an impression of that.
Right.
So that's next time.
Little teaser for you.
Yeah.
We're close to an hour. Do we want to do final thoughts? Is there anything else you want to hit here?
I have a couple things I want to touch on. The first is perhaps the most significant line of dialogue in the whole show, which is when Lindsay Zanna says, oh, God, I got to go back up to the top here. I so apologize for this, everyone. Okay, here we go. So the sitcom actor, I believe, was Grant Patrizio, who says, what do we say to strangers, Julie? And Lindsay Zanna says, thanks for the candy. And we, like, didn't want to have to find an 8-year-old. Later, we, like, found a 3-year-old. So props to us. But we just asked Lindsay if she could do that. And she did it and nailed it. And then literally from that one line, like, I was like, we need – that was the line that made me say we need to do something more with this person we've brought in to play someone who only appears in archival footage.
What do we say to strangers, Julie?
Thanks for the candy.
And so I have always thought of that as the most significant line of dialogue in the show, because to that point, we kind of had as a loose rule that we didn't make fun of the crime, but to that point, the crime had been a lot more, it didn't feel like it had happened to real people. And then when we started thinking about Julie as a real person, that's when I think a lot of stuff started to click, even beyond like the episode 11 of it all. So we can thank Lindsay Zanna for that.
Yes. Our deepest, deepest thanks to Lindsay Zanna.
And I think this is a place where I want to shout out Libby for being the one who's like, you need a star as Julie.
Mm-hmm.
Lindsay is a star.
Yeah, because we knew we wanted Lindsay in there, and we were kind of like, is she in the ensemble? Is she, you know, one of the other characters? And Libby was adamant that she should play Julie, because I don't even remember why Libby was there that day, but she was. So
she's there to help out. Yeah. She really did.
Yeah, and she was right, as she so often is. And I also wanted to talk about the think scene, which I know that we have thoughts on. So, cause that to me was when Michelle and Tracy fell into the rhythm that they, ultimately occupied for the bulk of the season.
Yes. Yes. Because in the scheduling of that first day, aside from like a 1-hour block where Lindsay Zanna came in and did all the stuff we'd written for her to that point, we purposefully scheduled that day so it would only be Michelle and Tracy, so that they could figure out their relationship. We could sort of figure out how they were going to play off each other, that sort of thing. But if I recall correctly, they did that scene in the audition as well. That was one of the audition scenes. And I think that was the scene that sold us that they could do it.
Yeah.
And once they hit that scene, I think on that sort of first day of recording, that's when they really started to click into gear. Yeah. And pretty much by that afternoon, they had figured out how they were going to play off each other.
Yeah.
And we had a show.
Yeah, the show doesn't work if those two don't work together. And like, we knew they worked together from auditions, but I remember that first morning I was a little nervous because, again, they just did a bunch of monologues and it wasn't quite working. It wasn't quite right. And then they argued about Thing and Think, which is one of the few things that stayed the same from the very first draft. And it clicked into place in a way that I think made the rest of the show easier to write.
Well, you've got another Think coming.
You know, I think it's you got another thing coming.
Just tell me what your evidence is. And it's Think. That makes sense. Thing doesn't make any sense in context.
You've got another Think coming? Who talks like that?
A 1910 society heiress. It's verbal dexterity. It's something you wouldn't understand if it...
Nice to see you still get worked up over the stupidest shit. And it's Thing. Most people say Thing. Just admit you lost.
Think.
This is one other thing I want to ask, which is how far along in writing were we when we started recording? I feel like we had 4, but maybe we had 5.
On that first weekend, we recorded things from episode 1, from episode 2, from episode 3, from episode 4, from episode 5, and episode 7.
Okay. I know we wrote 6 super late.
Yeah.
And well, we'll get to 6.
I was going to say, when I say we, that's like the one I had. I pitched one line. That was my contribution to episode 6. But yeah, like
we were intentionally putting episode 6 off so that it could so that it could fill in whatever it needed to be once we'd written everything else.
Yeah.
So I would consider that. As we were halfway through, if we had episode 7, that means we're halfway through the season.
Yeah, like Arden's recording days were kaleidoscopic in nature. Let's put it like that.
Yeah. So let's give me your final thoughts on the pilot, since we have talked for quite a while. What's the thing you think works really well? What's the thing you wish we had done better? And then just kind of an overall look at it. We'll start with you, Chris.
Yeah, so I think a thing that works really well, and this was a thing that we actually did have to do a bit of retakes on to try to figure out. I think a thing that works well is Bea and Brenda's introductions and the sense of their conflict. So I think you pretty quickly get a sense of who these two people are, why they are in conflict, not just because of like whatever position but they're in, but also philosophically why they're in conflict. And so I think the pilot sells you on the fact that not only is there this external case that's going to be solved, but that this is also going to be the story of these two people. In terms of things that I think could be handled better, I'm going to come back to the exposition because there is just so much of it. And on the one hand, you kind of have to get through it because we do have to say this is a true crime show and we do have a lot of exposition in setting up the case and setting up the world and setting up all of these things. I do wish we had found a more elegant solution.
Right.
In how to deliver some of it.
Right. It's a conceit of the genre, but we thought we were in a different genre than we ultimately ended up in, if that makes sense. Sarah.
No, I think that's fair.
Sarah, what are your thoughts?
As far as the negative Pretty much that. It's very piloty, as you might say, intelligent. it's gotta do all the setup, and in order to subvert expectation, we have to just do the thing people are expecting, which is just always the boring part of subverting expectations.
Yeah.
I like it. I'm looking at the final transcript, which is available on our website.
ardenpodcast.com.
Yes, ardenpodcast.com/transcripts if you want to get right to it. And it's 22 pages, the final cut. So, like, you know, we got it down there.
It is our shortest episode. It's 39 minutes, and most of the others are in the 45 to 50 range. So,
yeah, we gutted this because I think this was the one that we had the most time to tinker with, because after this, it was a weekly release.
Right. We got the first cut of this in, like, February.
Yeah.
And which is why there were pickups.
I think there's a lot of good stuff here. I think it, you know, there's the info dump, but it sets up the case, it sets up the characters, it sets up what the genre and tone is and what we're playing with. I think it is just a great job getting you into the world of Arden. And I guess since there's nowhere else to put this, I'd like to shout out a late edition scene, which is the Bia feeling responsible because she was like the last one to interview Julie, which was something that we came up with late because we felt like her driving force was just not hitting right.
Right.
Because she was just like, she had just really emotionally connected to Julie, which I think is something that never leaves the show, but it was just sort of hard to convey the intensity of that because it's like I know what it's like to just, you know, you watch someone's movies like a bunch of times and you're like, they're kind of my friend and I care what happens to them, but it's just sort of, it wasn't coming across in her speech. And that interview where she talks to Julie, I think even just really plants the seeds that like Julie is a real person that we will be hearing more from.
Do you think you're defined by what people want to see? Like Hollywood, right? That's all about trying to turn you into a product?
I don't know. I keep thinking I'm going to find a place there. Like, I'll find my people, right? My mom did. I don't know why I can't. They've got to be around.
We also aged Bia up quite a bit. Not quite a bit, but we aged her up into someone who was just out of college, and we aged Julie down. So it made less sense that Bia was like obsessed with Julie Capson. Like,
right.
It was like if, you know, a recent college graduate right now was like obsessed with like Elsie Fisher or something. I don't know. Like, actually, that's probably really plausible. So I don't know why I just suggested that as something crazy.
Who's the Sally Draper actress? Because I do feel like if something happened to her, I would be devastated.
Kieran Shipka?
Yes.
Kieran, if you want to play Julie in the TV show, give us a call. I think that the thing that for me doesn't quite work beyond, I guess, what we've already talked about. I think we hit the aliens beat a few too many times. Like, we cut it way down from what it was in the original pilot. I think we hit it a lot. And then it doesn't return throughout the show as much as I think we thought it was going to. And like, it's not bad or anything. I think there are some good jokes there, but it's also like, I don't know. I think it kind of gets.
Yeah, similar. That was much longer.
Yeah, originally. There was a lot more of it.
Ugh, boy.
Well, we heard from people that they actually thought aliens were going to be part of the show. And that's the thing I regret, is it's like, we set up some fun supernatural stuff we don't pay off on. And it's like, I knew we never were going to, so I didn't see the problem. But like, now that it's out there.
I draw the line at extraterrestrials, but cryptids are okay.
The skunk ape is real.
Yeah.
Also, like, no one ever comes at us for the fact that the skunk ape is real. Like, they're like, yay, no one's ever like, this was a grounded show. You introduced the cousin of Bigfoot.
The thing that I really like is I really like the cliffhanger. I really think that the phone call from the cabin is a really good understated cliffhanger that leaves me wanting to know more. And I remember being quite frustrated when I started getting drafts of other like scripts, and we weren't immediately talking about that. But also, like, it, as a cliffhanger, it doesn't leave you a lot of room to maneuver in. But I think it works really well as like a tease to watch the rest of the show. And I've heard that the people who aren't like in on the torso, I've heard people be like, "Oh, the phone call is kind of that notion that there's this mystery phone call in the middle of the night." Really seemed to grab people. And we didn't know who was making it for the longest time, but spoilers, it was Natalie.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're listening to this before listening to the entire show, what are you doing?
We really should wrap this up, but does anybody want to tease something from season two, which we are just starting to work on?
I would like to tease that we're definitely going to know who's in what, who's in cabins and who's making phone calls and if aliens are involved before we record. That is my promise to you.
I reserve the right to completely change it at the last minute if we feel like we should. Chris, do you want to
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely pushing for ghosts to be real. there's your tease for season two. Regardless of what does or does not show up, I believe ghosts are going to appear. Maybe okay. You don't see them because it's an audio drama.
All right. Season two tease. Here's one for you. We are going to find out about other true crime shows in the world of Arden.
I'm going to tease that we will have a major new character, sort of the Julie Capsom of season two, and her name is Dana Hamill, and we think she lives in Montana. We haven't quite nailed that down, but we think she lives in Montana, she perhaps is conflicted about the death of her father, and I can't wait to talk more about
it. Teased.
Yeah.
Teased enough.
No. That's actually all just in the season finale. So like all you know now is that she has a name.
It's too much. I
can't
wait to go back.
Yeah. So thank you so much for listening to this. I can't imagine who did, but if you did, thank you. Gold star. Yes. Congratulations. Thanks. We are going to do commentaries like this on all the episodes. We're probably going to do more stuff like this. It's going to be Patreon exclusive. So if you want to hear more of this, head over to Patreon, give us a couple bucks. We'd really appreciate it. It's going to help us fund season two, where we are really like intent on paying everybody closer to what they're worth. There's no way we can ever pay them what they're worth on our indie podcast budget, but we want to get closer. So that's patreon.com/ardenpod. You also can find us at ardenpodcast.com. We're on Twitter at twitter.com/ardenpod, Instagram, Tumblr, Facebook, all those places, basically ardenpod. We're on YouTube. And if you haven't listened to the show, we've spoiled a bunch of it for you, but go check it out. It's on.
Yeah.
It's on all major podcatchers.
Spoiler warning right at the top of this episode, actually. Mm-hmm. Yes, and I would like to reiterate, like, the three of us are doing this 100% out of love of the game, for the craft of it all. Every cent that goes into Patreon is going to our production team and our actors. It is not going to us. You are free to Venmo us money individually, but we just want to, like... Sometimes you donate money and you don't know what's going. I give you my full assurance it's going straight to our amazing cast and crew.
Who hopefully will get some of them on future commentaries.
Yes.
And discussions.
So if you really want to hear from somebody in the cast or somebody in the crew, please let us know, because we'd love to have them on. And like, we can't just be the three of us, because we'll clearly talk past each other until we've talked for an hour and a half.
But we'll be on episode 7 and be like, we're still here.
I think we should bring Robert in for that one and just turn him loose. He has so many stories.
Yeah. I did not mean to pick on episode 7, but definitely let's get Robert in. He's so good. I like listening to his voice. We should cast him in something.
Well, thank you so much for listening, everybody. You can find other episodes of this again on Patreon, and we have other fun stuff there, so please check us out. Until then, thank you for listening to Arden, and good night.
Thank you, and good night.
Good night.
The Fable and Folly Network, where fiction producers flourish.
Modes of thought in Antaran literature. Second year classics, Harvard University.
7 years ago, a Chinese military sub accidentally went down in the Pacific Ocean. Turns out, the sub fell smack in front of a gigantic three-sided pyramid in the ruins of what we now call Dark City.
This Antaran lit class seems like there's a lot of debate about it.
Legally, I cannot stop you from teaching this class, but I strongly advise that
what?
You know what? If you want to tank your reputation, that's on you.
You don't believe a word I say about Antara, right?
You're right. I do not believe Antara exists.
I need to know. Is it real? You came all the way to China to find out?
Okay, everyone get out right now. Now, Raquel, what the hell are you doing?
I'm going to cut my hand, and you're all going to feel it.
Ow!
See? I told you.
Modes of Thought in Antaran Literature, an audio drama produced by Wolf of the Door Studios. For more information, please visit WLFDR.com.